is this concept of a genotype diet. It is remarkable how infrequently I can get out of any kind of an audience's presence without someone asking me a question on this topic. So we thought we'll call someone in who's truly an expert in this arena, someone who's written a book on it, in fact, called The Genotype Diet.
He started it.
Peter D'Adamo, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Live your best life with Dr. Oz.
Coming up next on Oprah and Friends. Long before he was my friend, Dr. Mehmet Oz was somebody I really admired. Because the first time I heard him speak, I knew that if I ever got sick, that's who I wanted to be my doctor. You can ask him anything. He's going to help you live a healthier life. Here's Dr. Oz.
Welcome to Open Friends, Dr. Oz. Here coming to you from Jazz at Lincoln Center. I've got Lisa and Mike in the studio today. You know, one of the questions that Mike and I get asked a lot as we give groups of folks talks on longevity and dieting and the insights on how your body works is this concept of a genotype diet or a blood type diet. And I don't know why so many folks resonate to it, but it is remarkable how infrequently I can get out of any kind of an audience's presence without someone asking me a question on this topic. So we thought, instead of us trying to figure this out on our own, we'll call someone in who's truly an expert in this arena, someone who's written a book on it, in fact, called The Genotype Diet. He's written others as well.
He started it.
And talk a little bit about why blood type might be an important predictor of which kinds of foods are in our best interest and how that might reflect the blood type that is our genotype. And Peter D'Adamo, thank you for joining us.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Let me tell folks just a tiny bit about you. You spent a lot of time, obviously, writing on these topics. It's taken for about 25 years, you've become a dominant voice in the arena of blood type, food, and disease. Eat Right for Your Type, published in 1996, was a New York Times bestseller and brought worldwide attention to some of the things that you've been talking about. You've been involved in this discussion at many different levels, and you're the heart and the soul behind the D'Adamo Clinic, which is in Wilton, Connecticut. Is that right?
That's right.
How far is that from New York?
About an hour.
All right, so not too far. All right, so teach us first about how you got started in this. What tipped you off?
Well, the diet actually came from my father originally. So basically, almost 40 years ago, he, early naturopathic doctor, studied in some of the spas that were well-known at the time, the European spas, and came back with suggestions that you would now call a plant-based or a spa diet. But it wasn't very long before he saw that some people didn't do well on that. And it appeared that there was a contrary kind of component, that some people did better on high-protein diets. And, you know, the Atkins diet was popular at the time, so there certainly was a basis for it. And he tried to come to an understanding of how he could come up with a signpost, some marker that might be able to tell him who would be better suited for a plant-based diet and who might be better suited for a diet that was more, perhaps, animal protein-centered. Mm-hmm. And he looked at blood type, I think, for some reasons that I think were surprising. And I understand that some people might think the idea is somewhat crazy, because when I was a student, I thought it was crazy. And I had to do a report
So it was really your father who started this?
That's really, yeah, James D'Adamo.
And so now you've evolved it from blood types to more than blood types to genotype.
Well, he looked at it in terms of just a very simple thing. You poke people in the finger, and he saw that O's, for instance, didn't do that well on plant-based diets. When I was a student, I thought, well, I can at least go back and look at the studies and see, well, who got sick from what. And it turned out there were a lot of studies on blood type and disease. For instance, if you go to Medline, which has probably about 13,000 articles on blood type, about 4,000 of them have nothing to do with transfusions. They have to do with physiology and pathology. And it was interesting that the diseases that were thought to be linked to eating a diet wrong, as per vegetarianism or high protein, tended to organize along blood type. Hmm. More heart disease, more cancer in type A, and that's a blood type that generally does better on vegetarian type diets, do better on soy products and things.
Type A does.
Yeah.
That's me.
Miss Lisa. Lisa's vegan. Now, I must say, I have a difficult time not having some meat protein in my diet. I don't eat it much, once a week. But I know that there are friends of mine who have been vegan for a decade, and one day they just crack, and they say, I can't do it anymore. I just didn't like it anymore. I didn't like the way I felt. I thought I was losing some of my vital energy. And so I always sort of wondered what we could do to predict that ahead of time. Just take us back for one second, because a lot of listeners may not know that much about the blood type diet other than their blood type and maybe what diet they should be on. I assume that part of the foundation of your father's thought process around this and yours as well is that humans evolved into three different blood types, which sort of represent how we move geographically around the planet.
That's true, actually. There's a lot of anthropology locked up into blood type. And the listeners really should understand that we're really talking about the ABO blood type. We're talking about the one that makes you an A, a B, an O, or an AB. And inevitably, somebody says, well, what about the negative and positive? I mean, what does that mean? And it turns out that it doesn't mean very much. The thing that makes, for instance, me an A, or you an A, is a chemical that's all through our body. It's a very limited idea to call it a blood type, but we do in medicine because of its role in transfusions. But it turns out that there's more of your blood type lining your digestive tract than there is on your red blood cells.
Mm-hmm.
If you were to pick up a copy of a book I'm sure everybody is familiar with in the room, but most listeners wouldn't, but Guyton's Physiology, this thing you learn in medical school.
it's not a bestseller outside of medical school.
It's a great book, though.
Guyton's Physiology has an interesting little graph in it that looks at the development of how a person makes antibodies to other blood types. Now, of course, people know that if you put the wrong blood in somebody, something terrible happens.
Mm-hmm.
It's because, for instance, we have a blood type A, so we can't accept blood from somebody who's B. Now, why would we not want to be able to accept blood from somebody who's B? It would seem to be not a very smart idea. But it's not the blood of other people that we're rejecting. It's all the things in the environment that look like blood type B. And our blood type is a very common chemical in the environment. It's found on fungus and viruses and bacteria, and it's found in foods. And in this little page in Guyton's Physiology, medical textbook that every medical student reads, has a chart that shows how that antibody starts at almost nothing and rises as you get older, as you start to eat foods that have that ability to mimic these other blood types. So the blood type diet is not necessarily about blood at all. It's actually about relating to the environment, and just happens to be that this blood type thing is part of how you you parse the environment, how you sort out friend from foe, from non-friend.
Explain, if you could, a little bit about which kinds of foods particularly irritate an O, an A, and a B. And what is it chemically in those foods that might tweak the gastrointestinal system? By the way, Peter, I never heard that we have more of the antigens in our digestive system than we do in our red blood cells. It makes perfect sense in retrospect.
Especially if the person is what's called a secretor, which if you watch enough TV crime shows, it comes up periodically. About 90% of us secrete our blood type in our secretions. So they're not only in our blood, they're not only in our digestive tract, but if you're a man, they're in your semen, it's in your digestive fluids, tears, perspiration, sweat, saliva, blood type. Mainly because your body is throwing your blood type out to seed the environment. It's making a sort of a call that says, this is me, who are you? So anytime you come in contact with anything that's a place where microbes or the environment comes in contact with your immune system, your blood type is being sent out as a herald, as sort of a clarion call. It says, mm-hmm. This is who I am. Who are you? Now, you know, with the thing about blood types in general is that medicine, I mean, I knew this. You can talk to an average medical person. They can give you a tremendous amount of information on blood type. But it's all about what they teach you in medical school, which mm-hmm. is transfusions.
Right.
But basically, blood types, I always tell that when I give lectures that, you know, if you just reverse engineer that whole thing, you see how silly it is. Because in medical school, you're taught that blood type is a transfusion complication. But obviously, there's deeper reasons why it's there. And ultimately, there are physiological reasons. And, you know, to answer your question about the diet part, there's a lot of things linked up to blood type. I'll pick a few.
Okay.
Let's say somebody's type O.
Mm-hmm.
Very common blood type.
And this is what I am.
Great blood type to basically be a sort of a more of a lean, what they call a paleo diet, hunter-gatherer diet. Now, it's been known since the 1960s that people who are blood type O have very high levels of an enzyme in their digestive tract that splits cholesterol. And this enzyme is called IAP, long name, intestinal alkaline phosphatase. This enzyme's job is to split cholesterol and help you absorb calcium in your small intestine.
Mm-hmm.
It's highest in blood type O and lowest in blood type A. And here's the kicker, which I always got a kick out of from the dietary standpoint, is that this enzyme, which allows you to split cholesterol and assimilate calcium, is turned on by protein. So the more protein you eat, the better you are able to make an enzyme, at least if you're blood type A, mm-hmm. that allows you to split cholesterol and absorb calcium. Now, the calcium part is in direct contradiction to what people tell you about calcium absorption and protein intake, which is you're supposed to not eat a lot of protein to maximize your calcium intake. Right. But here, in this 40% of the population, the rule goes the other way. Now, if you're type A, on the other hand, and you eat animal products, you basically fry your arteries, because type A makes a lot of these what are called endothelial markers. They're little pieces of suction cups on your artery walls. And when you eat a lot of meat, you basically turn on a machinery that makes your arteries start flapping like a Venetian blind and cause a lot of damage.
I love that imagery. That's wonderful.
That's actually how it works, because most people don't realize when you get a splinter, your white blood cell has to get out to the splinter, and it takes a ride on your cardiovascular system until it gets, like on exit on the highway, it says here, I got you off at exit 14, and then it tickles the artery wall, and the artery wall opens up to let it out. But if you're type A, you eat a lot of meat, that mechanism just starts flying off the handle. So at least from the 1950s, there's just probably 60 articles. Clear cut, if you're type A, you have a much higher rate of heart disease. Mathematically, it's like, look at the cholesterol drug industry. You know, we have a multi-billion-dollar industry based upon controlling cholesterol. Cholesterol risk factor, which mm-hmm. means basically if I have elevated cholesterol, my risk of going on and getting heart disease is about 2.2. Mm-hmm. I'm about twice as likely to get heart disease from elevating cholesterol than someone who doesn't have elevated cholesterol. You look at you take all the data on blood type, and you round it up, and it comes out to be about 1.8, mm-hmm. which is almost the same, not quite. Right. But how many people give you drugs based on your blood type to prevent heart disease?
Right.
Now, this has been known since the 50s. Every study that's basically looked at, there was one study that showed that blood type A didn't have more heart disease than all the other blood types. And when they went back and looked at it, they realized that the reason it didn't show that blood type A had heart disease was because the people they were studying were old and all the A's were already dead. So in essence, one of the things... So now I find it interesting that, we don't pay that much attention to this, but it's such a simple fact.
Well, but Peter, let's give some credence. In honesty, we can do something to change the cholesterol level. We can't do something that changes our blood type level. We've got to change, if you will, what we do in the environment related to our blood type versus...
Right. Absolutely.
And so the drug companies obviously seize on, and pharmaceutical companies in making money say, we can give something else that we sell. Whereas in the other case, if you will, it's changing what you eat, which doesn't make any money for very many people.
It doesn't. And also, too, what it does do, and this, I think, is why sometimes the opposition to this work is sometimes so vehement from the nutritional community, as I think about it, if you're saying all of a sudden that a major component of the human diet is good in 40% of the population, you're implying that it's bad in 40% of the population.
Right, 60%.
Well, and you throw the other blood type B and AB in there, and you're not, you're in this kind of thing where ultimately, whose feet are you stepping on in terms of the food industry? I mean, you look at the pyramid, and it's a grain-based pyramid. Generally nothing wrong with that if they're well chosen. It's fruits and vegetables. It's generally nothing wrong with that. But you're really talking about maybe five or six individual pyramids. And
right.
I mean, you look at personalized medicine. If I used to Google this every year, the phrase personalized medicine. And when I first started Googling it, you'd get like 100 hits. But now you get like 40,000 hits.
Peter D'Adamo, before we go to break, real quickly, people with blood type B, which is the least common of the three major ones.
That's right.
What's their pitfall?
Idiosyncratic omnivore. And these are the people that really almost wind up being, they're hard to categorize. A's are easy to categorize, vegetarian. O's are easy to categorize, Fred Flintstone, Paleolithic.
Fred.
B's, on the other hand, because...
Mehmet, I think he just called you Fred.
B's, on the other hand, it's because of their blood type is relatively unique molecule, the interactions that take place on a molecular basis are more idiosyncratic. They have to do with little proteins that are called lectins. They're found in the diet that come in foods and things, and they react with your blood type. So I'll give you a classic example. If you're a B, You probably shouldn't eat too much chicken, but on the other hand, turkey doesn't cause any reaction whatsoever.
Well, on that note, talking to Peter Diadamo, he's the author of Eat Right for Your Type. And when we come back, we're going to talk about his new book, The Genotype Diet, Change Your Genetic Destiny to Live the Longest, Fullest, and Healthiest Life Possible. It's a book that breaks us down into six major categories. He's going to help us understand which of those six categories you might be in, a little bit of an insight into what our pitfalls may be. And then Mike and I and Lisa are going to ask some questions about some of the assumptions that we would have to make in order to use this in our lives. Dr. Oz, Open Friends, be right back.
Friends. Take charge of your health. It's Dr. Mehmet Oz.
Oprah and Friends, XM 156.
Welcome back, Dr. Oz, here, Oprah and Friends. We're at Jazz Lincoln Center with Lisa and Mike. We've got a wonderful guest with us today, Peter Diadamo, who's opened many of the listeners' eyes to the possibility that the blood type might be an important determinant of which foods are in your best interest. He was the author of Live Right for Your Type. His new book just came out, The Genotype Diet, Change Your Genetic Destiny to Live the Longest, Fullest, and Healthiest Life Possible. Peter, the reason I'm so fascinated by this latest book is you go more in detail into this whole field of genomic medicine, and I must say most of us are sort of intimidated by the concept of epigenetics, that the idea that there are specific markers in our cells that might make us susceptible to one drug, not another. This is
even the word is bad. Epi.
Even the word is tough. This is without any question for all you listening out there. This is where American medicine is going. We may not get there the way Peter wants us to go there, but I can assure you that we are spending more and more time trying to figure out how we can customize the therapies we give our patients. So that by giving one drug that we know will only work in 80% of people, we won't shotgun it and sacrifice 20 folks for the benefit of 80. This is most evident in cancer therapies today, which are already using these types of markers conveniently.
Well, even in high blood pressure control, there are differences between African Americans and Caucasians. Right. And in virtually everything, I mean, we use it with beta blockers and pre-op. Some patients benefit, some don't. So it's getting to be more common.
So the intriguing possibility was raised by Peter Diadamo that maybe the same system might also apply to the foods we're eating and why some foods might be in our best interest and others not. So walk us through, first of all, if you could define what epigenetics is, and then teach us about how you decided to go from blood type, which is in many ways reflection of that, but not as detailed, to the current system that you've crafted.
Well, epigenetics is, like the word says, epi, it means above genetics. And so really, in order to understand epigenetics, you have to understand that really all the genetics that we were taught in medical school, or the listeners may have learned in high school biology, is basically all wrong. The idea basically...
A bit startling, a revelation.
Yeah, Mendel and his pea plants basically is not how things occur in real time. I think ultimately if we had to depend upon that kind of natural selection to change and result to environmental problems and things, we'd be long dead. So it turns out that we understand that certain genes in our body are stronger or dominant than other genes. So for instance, I have brown eyes because I wound up with alternative versions that are stronger than my father's blue-eyed version. So I have brown eyes. Brown eyes are dominant.
Well, wait a second. There are other causes but potentially available.
Well, you know, I'll just have to kind of...
Family radio. All right, so go ahead.
So a lot of the thing that went into us at conception, which actually you could almost consider a type of blueprint, you know, it's a blueprint for you. And then there's the process of how you became you, or in the case of how you on a diet became you. But basically what that is a series of trade-offs that occur between what the blueprint was and what the environment was able to get out of the resources and all the other things that went into your physical version of yourself, which we call in medicine a phenotype. So there's a long road that goes from the blueprint, which is conception, to how you wound up to be the way you are. And it's been likened as a trip through a landscape of various choices, and those choices might be your family history, it might be elements in terms of the weaknesses that are conveyed in your family, or the environmental aspects that took place at the prenatal stage in your life, or nutrient changes that you underwent in the early stages of childhood. But it turns out that all of these things don't make genes go on and off. They make genes go softer and louder. So it isn't that ultimately these factors basically change your genes, which you can't do, but they alter how the gene is being expressed. So in order to understand that, it's nice to just think of the genes as having like a volume control on them. And this volume control is constantly being manipulated by the environment. And if it sounds to me like, as it might sound to you, a little unrealistic, just think of that first cigarette that you might have smoked and how unpleasant that was. Mm-hmm. But if you kept it up, how eventually something unpleasant became pleasant and then became habituating, and all of a sudden you realize that it was a genetic event that occurred, an epigenetic event that was all of a sudden enzymes in your liver that were being turned on to help you break down this thing.
Right.
So it's a perfect example of how genes are constantly... We could say, well, I don't want to manipulate my genes, but the environment's doing it all the time. And so ultimately, if you look at what we bring to the picture, family tendencies towards Alzheimer's, family's tendencies towards autism or learning disabilities, family's tendencies towards obesity, all those things are locked up not in your genes, but in the pattern of how those volume controls on each of the genes is turned on and off. And the kicker, and I'll turn it over for discussion if you guys want at that point, is that it's heritable. So those changes to the volume controls are as able to be inherited as the genes themselves. So when your mom basically did something, when your great-grandfather worked at a lead mill or played with arsenic or basically had certain types of habits, those aspects will be conveyed through that family genome as part of this epigenome, a series of programming that occurs on top of the gene. And that's something that you start out with and eventually manipulate your own way as you go through this landscape throughout your life, and then pass that change on to the next generation.
Peter, I've got to say, I had never heard that before. I mean, it's fascinating. How do you actually go about proving that? And take the example of lead exposure. How do you prove that your grandfather had lead exposure, and that might change, for example, the ability of your genome to react one way versus the other?
Well, that's a very good animal study. That looks at, for instance, they took certain types of xenobiotics or man-made chemicals and gave them to animals and checked for hormonal alterations, and they found that not only were these occurring in subsequent generations, but they were often skipping the first generation. Mm-hmm. We know, why are people so fat nowadays in this country? Not necessarily because of the diet, and that may be part of it, but the nature of what we call a thrifty phenotype, which is a person who's programmed for metabolic thriftiness. Now, for a listener to understand, think of the word thrifty in terms of money. When somebody's thrifty with money, it means they hold on to every little nickel they make.
Right.
But a person with a thrifty metabolism is programmed to hold on to every calorie that they make. And it turns out that thriftiness is something that is developed in utero. And they know that because they studied starvation that occurred in World War II in Holland, and found that when the Dutch people had this tremendous famine at the end of World War II, when they followed the subsequent generations, they found higher rates of diabetes, autism, learning disorders, hypertension, and they came to the conclusion that there's a kind of analysis that occurs in utero, where essentially the mother and the placenta and the fetus work together to assay what the environment outside is. And they use that to program the fetus, in which case, this case, the fetus is programmed for scarcity. So now the fetus goes out and the war ends and you've got all these abundant calories, but you're programmed for scarcity.
Yeah.
So what are you going to do if you're metabolically programmed for scarcity, but you're in an environment full of easily attainable calories?
Why would it skip a generation?
I don't know. I don't know.
That's fascinating. I mean, I was aware.
We know this with pesticides, too, that we adapt to pesticides so that we, in fact, then get to be able to handle them better in our environment.
And I also knew that the mother's weight, for example, will influence the chance of the child becoming a type 2 diabetic, not type 1, type 2 diabetic. So it does make sense at that level. I just never thought about it in the context of prior experiences in the life of the person, especially the father.
I said before I was looking at personalized medicine in Google.
Right.
Well, if you Google intergenerational medicine, you get exactly one hit. And it's somebody who does counseling for moms and daughters. But can you imagine that this is the future, that actually we are not going to cure illness. We're going to eliminate it intergenerationally. Because basically you can, just like the environment will play with your genes in a negative way most of the time, we now know that things that are euphemistically called enriching experiences by the authors of the studies, methylating agents and antioxidants, proper diet, proper proteins. What do we do with kids who are like the age of my daughter, 16-year-olds? We tell them to be thin. We tell them that basically you can't be too thin. And the messages that they get are that, you know, you
right.
can't. Well, it turns out that that's the worst of all times in your life to be thin, because you're getting ready to nourish another life.
Yep.
And so what are they doing at that point? They're interpreting it as scarcity.
Sure.
So ultimately, over 3 or 4 generations, we can produce a diabetes epidemic in this country, which is scary. But think about how scary it's going to be in China when they rise to the Western level, but they're also programmed for scarcity, too. It's going to be a diabetes epidemic.
In fact, they're programmed more. They're more at the same BMI. They're 60 times more likely, their genotype is, to get type 2 diabetes. So it's really a real...
Well, Peter's arguing some of that may be their genes. Some of them may be epigenetic, you know, lifestyle events, because they also had their famine after the Second World War. So we're talking to Peter D'Adamo, author of Eat Right for Your Life, but of his new book's called The Genotype Diet, Change Your Genetic Destiny to Live the Longest, Fullest, and Healthiest Life Possible. Let's get on the brass tacks. 6 major genotypes that you argue exist. They've all got sexy names, by the way. And you know, I was trying to figure out which one I want to be. It's the first thing most people do. I want to be the warrior. No, actually, the nomad looks pretty good.
You know, I gave him Greek letters. And everybody told me I was going to be the most boring thing in the world. So then I read Richard Dawkins, and he talked about memetics.
Yes.
And I thought to myself, okay, let's give him a meme. You know, make him a teacher and an explorer or whatever.
That's so true. All right, so you can do it one of two ways. You can either walk us through the 6 genotypes, or you can explain how you can tell what genotype you are.
Okay.
Which one you want to do? It's up to you.
I think I like the latter.
Okay.
Because it's much more cooler than simply grinding through the grok and that stuff.
Okay.
But you know, one of the things I think ultimately that makes this book so alluring to me as a creator of systems, I suppose, is it's a book on genes and diet that doesn't require genetic testing, okay. Of which basically, you know, I'm kind of parsimonious, and so this is a very nice thing. It turns out the best way to measure yourself epigenetically is not to measure yourself genetically. Remember what I said in the beginning, phenotype is who you are.
Right.
It's the best way to measure your epigenetic tendencies is to actually measure you. Because you, like Freud said many, many years ago, Freud said anatomy is destiny.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately your anatomy is basically a record of your destiny. So you can do simple things in this book, like look at the difference between the length of your index finger and the length of your ring finger. And that tells you about a certain level of activity of a certain gene called the Hox gene, which actually controls how you compartmentalized yourself, where your head came and where your foot came. And that tells you a little bit about androgens and estrogens in utero.
Explain that a bit more. I've actually heard this. Mike and I have been writing on this for our next book. So I want to learn from you. So I looked at mine and Lisa. So my index finger is shorter than my ring finger. And Lisa's is the opposite.
Well, that's because you're the same length.
But your index is a tiny bit longer, so I look from here.
So your ring is longer?
My ring is longer. So
he's a male, right?
Yeah. Yeah,
I could have told that.
Well, I know that was partly what we figured out, but that was at the very classic level, male versus female. But you mentioned how we compartmentalize things. What does that mean?
Well, how do you know where to put your head when you're being born? Right? You start out as a circle.
Right.
Well, it turns out that there's a game plan involved that's called a Hox genes that are basically, it's a long name, I'll spare you the trouble. But basically, it turns out that you align yourself along certain imaginary areas. Like, for instance, where's the middle of you?
Right.
Well, a lot of that's under the influence of hormones, it's under the influence of diet, it's under the influence, because it's largely an epigenetic event. In order to grow, believe it or not, you have to die. The reason you often grow is because parts of you die and parts of you live.
Right.
So, in essence, one of the things that you look at with regard to finger length, or even the length of the lower leg compared to the length of the upper leg, is you're gauging levels of effects of estrogenizing compounds or androgenizing male-like female, or growth factors or growth hormones. And it's part of this anatomical record. And what I did when I looked at these things in terms of being able to develop these categories or these genotypes was, remember what I said, the originator of the theory looked at you going from nothing to something as a trip through a landscape. In other words, he likened it as actually rolling a marble down a mountain and having the marble go through various valleys.
Mm-hmm.
Every time you make a choice, you can't go back up and go into another valley because you didn't like this valley. Once you're down there, you're stuck.
Yeah.
And so the idea of the genotypes is that they represent a certain number of possible paths down the valley that include all the things that come with that path.
Got it. So finger length is one. Give us just 2 or 3 other examples so folks, as they're driving, leg length.
Yeah.
Compared to torso length or just period?
Upper leg to lower?
Okay.
You know, from the knee to the hip, and then from the knee to the foot. Big thing is how much the left side of you is like the right side of you. Because that's something called fluctuating asymmetry.
Right.
And fluctuating asymmetry, as any biologist will tell you, reflects developmental instability. The more unstable your development was, the less the right side of you looks like the left side of you. Which is why all the villains in Hollywood have very, very asymmetrical faces. Because we, evolutionarily, are programmed to see symmetry.
Whereas the good guys always have great symmetry.
Yeah. And actually, we choose our mates based upon symmetry.
Yeah, we actually, one of our colleagues is spending a lot of time on this, and we found that out as well, which sort of stunned me. But it does make sense, because it reflects not just our perception of beauty, but the fact that beauty reflects health, ultimately.
The left side of you goes through life not knowing what the right side of you does.
Right.
So in essence, really, because the thing down the middle of each one of us is absolute. It's an absolute line. So if you wanted to see how things, like for instance, if you go on a Long Island Sound, mm-hmm. and they're trying to figure out how the lobsters are doing, they compare the left claw to the right claw.
Right. All right. We're speaking with Peter D'Adamo. His new book, The Genotype Diet, Change Your Genetic Destiny to Live the Longest, Fullest, and Healthiest Life Possible. When we come back, I want to get into the big genotype choices here. There are six of them. I'm going to read them off, and I'll keep you tantalized until we come back for Peter to explain them. Are you the hunter, the gatherer, the teacher, the explorer, the warrior, and the nomad? When we come back, we'll learn from Peter about which of those you might be, how to tell yourself apart, and how that influences the kinds of foods and the lifestyle decisions you may need to make in your life. This is Dr. Oz, Oprah and Friends. Be right back.
Live your best life. Live your healthiest life. It's Dr. Mehmet Oz.
Oprah and Friends, XM 156.
And we're back. Dr. Oz here, Oprah and Friends, with Mike and Lisa at Jazz at Lincoln Center. Peter D'Adamo is gracing us today. His new book, The Genotype
Grazing
Diet.
Grazing us?
Grazing us. He's trying to get us to graze. We first grazed. We first grazed on Live Right for Your Type. Among his other honors, named Physician of the Year in 1990 by the American Association of Naturopathic Physicians. Your father's a naturopath. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. He's also teaching us today.
He's teaching us.
I mean, it's a great, great educational session on epigenetics.
And he's got the DNA.
And are you a warrior?
Yeah, well, actually, what are you, Peter? Start with you.
I'm a warrior.
You're a warrior. Now, define what a warrior is.
Largely blood type A. That's me.
Mm-hmm.
Big, long head. That's me.
Yeah, there's a long head. I was going to say that.
Artery.
Very Italian-looking head, by the way.
Artery problems in family. That's me. thrifty metabolism. That's me.
Okay.
So, you know,
And I noticed on his fingers, show your fingers, that the ring finger was longer than the index finger.
That's right.
But how many
does that correlate? How does that correlate with upper and lower leg length?
There's ways that you can just the way I came up with it in the book was to use some of these anatomical measurements as part of a calculator, and then once you got a certain number of possible genotypes, you then went through a series of things to strength test them, where you would do the fingerprints and compare left. That's the easiest way to compare the left and right side of you, is just fingerprint yourself and match them, book match them. And basically, you know, if they match 5 to 5, you're doing great. Mom took care of herself. But also other things. I mean, you know, one of the interesting things about fingerprints is, again, like blood type, there are hundreds of articles on disease associations. Simplest thing you
can... With fingerprints?
Yeah. I'm going to give you guys a Christmas present.
Please.
If somebody in your listenership essentially takes...
This is a late one. We should...
I'm half Spanish, so we'll do it for what? The King's Day on the 6th or something? Go get some ink, get some nice paper, fingerprint yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, easy to do. Look at the fingerprint. If the fingerprint has a series of white lines going through it,
mm-hmm.
you got a gluten sensitivity.
Actually, you know, my wife does this with developmental pediatrics. I thought she does it with the lines on the palm and the fingerprints.
Sydney line.
I don't know what the heck, but she does.
Actually,
it.
Mike has a simian crease.
That's
right. Prehistoric.
Anyway, my wife is a developmental pediatrician, if you will, hard science. So, but she actually does this with the kids, and you can do this. So this is
what does she look for?
I don't know.
What's she getting there? Why are you even here? Can Nancy in the line, please?
All right, so gluten sensitivity.
Right, and this will not be often picked up, for instance, because you're not looking at, for instance, a person who's genetically inclined to have celiac disease. You're looking to a person who's basically frittered away their intestinal lining.
Right.
Why? because your fingerprints don't change, right? That the FBI is banking on that.
Right.
However, the height of your fingerprints is relatively dynamic, and it changes with what's called the glycosylation pattern in your gut, because they're linked genetically. The genes that elaborate the protein and glycoprotein lining of your intestinal tract are linked to the genes that make your fingerprints luxurious or not. So when you see a white line on a fingerprint, it actually just looks like white lines going through the fingerprints. It means that the height of your fingerprints are so low that you're seeing the creases underneath your skin.
And the same thing is with the intestinal lining. It has less borders.
Yeah, it's linked to what are called brush border hydroxylases.
Right. Yep. Yeah, instead of looking like a coral reef, it looks more like the Appalachian Mountains. It was a lot of
a person who's going to have problems with prolamines, glutens, gliandins, lectins, allergens, anything that's capable of drilling into the intestinal tract and getting picked up by the lymphatics.
You know, we have a cast member, audience member from a recent show who was identified to have gluten allergies based on a biophysical 250 test. And she had very abnormal growth hormone levels and telomerase length. So we're actually curious about this because many listeners don't know they have the problem.
And in fact, she's one who had this incredible increase in telomere length when she changed her diet. Well, she did a couple things. She stopped smoking, too.
Yeah, she did. But that's you do have huge control over that. So, okay, so that's you've covered for us the warrior because it's basically you, Peter D'Adamo. Now, that's talk me. About the hunter.
Worst diet of them all is the one I wrote for myself.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Why? Because it's supposed to be a vegan diet?
It's close to it's just a hard diet.
Well, what is it? You're blood type A, you're long face, heart disease in the family. So it's a common American thing, right? A is more common than anything. So, I mean, you're
metabolic, yeah.
O is the most common, right?
Yeah.
No.
Roughly. Right. Well, 44 O, 40 A.
Yeah, O is just a little bit more.
Yeah, but I mean, it's almost he's almost a tie.
He's Mr. America.
Right?
He's Mr. America.
Okay, so this is
Mr. Catalunya.
So what's your diet that you're supposed to?
Yeah,
call
so why?
So
she's Lisa.
Well,
Lisa and I are closet.
I'm not a warrior. I'm a gatherer.
No, but I'm a closet.
She's already.
Classic vegetarian.
She's getting a physical exam right now. Peter's examining her. He's going to break out a little scalpel now.
You're probably a teacher.
I'm a teacher. I like that much better than the
gatherer. Because you have a lot of fingerprint whorls.
What does that mean?
It just means you have a lot of fingerprint whorls. It's a particular pattern that you have on your fingerprints. Now, here's another interesting thing. You go into Medline, look up fingerprint whorls.
Mm-hmm.
Women who have high levels of fingerprint whorls, very high associations with breast cancer. Mm-hmm. Good studies there. And actually, 6 whorls or more is considered to have a...
You know, her smile changed from a frown just now.
What's the whorl? Is that the thing right in the middle of my finger there?
No. Fingerprints come like ice cream in 3 basic flavors.
Okay.
You have the arch, which looks like a little mountain.
Right.
And it just kind of looks like that. Then you have the whorl, which kind of looks like a galaxy, you know, one a spiral galaxy.
Right.
And then you have loops that look like lassos.
Around the lasso, around the galaxy.
So it's like, well, no, it's just a different shape. So the loop pattern looks like this, the whorl pattern looks like this, and the arch pattern looks like this. I mean, you can't see what this is, folks, but I'm making my fingers go through the air.
Are these images in the book, by the way? Okay, good.
It's actually...
You're confused, go read the book.
The genotype die, change your genetic destiny, you'll learn what we're learning right now. All right. So Lisa's a teacher. What should... If she were a teacher, and let's see she is, because she was just...
Wait a second, she teaches your kids.
She's a teacher in many ways. What's the diet you should be eating?
The teacher diet, if you look at how the information basically coalesced statistically out of this galaxy of all these measurements and fingerprints and blood types, typically is it's a genotype that tends to demethylate with age. It tends to remethylate. Methylation is how you actually program your genes and turn them on and off. But there's methylation issues with this genotype, and there are also aspects. It's what's called a receptor type. They have very extravagant relationships with the environment as per how they sort of put out their blood type, and they put out all these other proteins.
Mm-hmm.
The genotypes have basic slants. There's the receptor type, which is the teacher, and the nomad. In other words, these are people who put out molecules in the environment to say, hey, this is me. So there's a lot of interaction with microbes, a lot of interaction with viruses, more statistically higher rates of certain types of cancers and things, because much of how you look for cancer is to get it to not look like you, which it wants to do very much. Two genotypes are what are called reactor types. That's the explorer and the hunter. These are people with overactive immune systems that tend to hyperreact to the environment. A lot of times this epigenetically occurs in things like we know that people who are raised in the city tend to have more allergies than people who are raised in the country.
Right.
So there's a provocation type component. So the hunter and the explorer tend to have a bias towards overreacting to the environment. Then the other two, the gatherer and the warrior, are what are called metabolic or thrifty types, and that their metabolisms tend to be the more of the issue. So you've got one type that embraces the environment, one type that rejects the environment, and one type that creates its own environment.
That's a very good way of thinking about it. So here, look at my finger. I've got the typical male pattern.
Oh, you got a really long finger. Yeah, long ring finger for sure.
Long ring finger.
But
yeah.
Look how lean you are.
Yeah.
Yeah, you would certainly be a hunter, I would almost suspect.
Its personality is very hunter, the way you describe it in the book.
How's that? I stalk my wife and...
No.
Hair trigger?
Yes. Very reactive, quick and powerful and...
Vulnerable, systemic burnout when overstressed. Yeah. Mike, you hear that? You're stressing me, Mike.
It's your fault.
Well,
now,
it's interesting,
Mike.
Actually, you bring this up, because I remember when I was a kid, I would always get fevers to 105, 107, I mean, really high fevers. And I wasn't sick much, but when it happened, we were talking about the immune response. My father was a physician as well. And we tried to figure out why some kids like me get such high fevers and other kids would have a much more stable response to an infection.
The hunter basically has if you look at the way it correlates with the parts of it that are disease susceptibility issues, there's a phenomenon called autophagy, which is quite upregulated in hunters. Mm-hmm. And that ultimately, this is kind of fun, but basically, you know, we have elimination systems, right? Our digestive tract, right. We go to the bathroom. Well, our cells go to the bathroom, too.
Mm-hmm.
And they do that by basically doing what's called the ubiquination reaction. So when all the cells done doing things, they got all these byproducts and they have to be eliminated through the Golgi apparatus. You might remember that from school.
Yeah.
Well, hunters tend to be not so good at that. Mm-hmm. And there's a polymorphism there. And it turns out that when you have a lot of buildup of these actual ubiquination molecules, it tends to make them very, very catabolic. Which is why that often they're very lean, very intense people. It's all the things. I mean, the hunters might be one of the more accurate memes, in that it does describe someone who's optimized, you know, for essentially a real time existence in that way.
So I'll be diagnosed Mike Royce's pathology.
His pathology.
So Mike, what kind of which of these genotypes does Mike fit into? Mike, but show me your fingers.
Well, the problem is I got such dry hands lately.
So it's a very feminine, almost aesthetic look.
His D2s are actually pretty long. They're up there. See, I mean, because you also have to realize that, you know, the index fingers are not
right.
Too... So, it's hard to say. I mean, ultimately, you're blood type A. And so, in essence, one of the things that we have to look at is probably a bit more. There's not enough that I can tell.
You get wrapped to show you're getting a rectal exam. That'll establish one and for all.
One finger or two.
Peter, as you try to take folks through this in the book, and this is a lot of material to get people to understand, what's sort of the best takeaway message for the average person? They're going to figure out which genotype they're in, and then they're going to have to adjust their diet. Now, obviously, it's not just simply vegan versus meat because you've got six genotypes. So can you break down the dietary options that you throw out to folks? Is it, you know, get rid of dairy, watch gluten? I mean, give us some of the litany of opportunities folks might want to take advantage of. Not eating anything is not an option.
No. I suppose if you're on the calorie-restricted thing for the thing, you know, not eating would be a good idea. But, you know, the funny part is I've been in this naturopathic thing for 25 years. That actually was the way I was taught, was that to get the patient and start taking things away until they got better. And it turned out that in 15 years in practice, I looked at the wall one afternoon because a patient canceled, and I got this brilliant breakthrough that it wasn't what I was taking away from people that was going to make them better. It was what I isolated that they should consume that was going to make them better.
Huh.
And so, in essence, the diets become just as important about what we're telling people, okay, eat. Now, this is not big breakthrough news or anything, but an emphasis, even in terms of where somebody should start, should not be necessarily looking where the book tells you to avoid foods. Go straight to where it says, eat this stuff. I think it's a good idea. And try to actually get a few of those things in your life. You will only get slightly less sick if somebody takes food away from you. But you will not get more healthy by somebody taking food away from you. You get more healthy by eating stuff.
Right.
So what we look at in terms of the hunter, number one genotype, largely blood type O, high protein, fish, lean meats, You know, when I wrote Eat Right for Your Type 10 years ago, I was talking about grass-fed beef and stuff like that. And it's, you know, nowadays it's common knowledge, but back then,
sure,
people would always criticize me and say, "How can you know, meat and fat and pesticides and stuff?" And I said, "Well, that's not what I want you to eat. I want you to eat this other stuff."
Yep.
Hunters, high protein, low lectin, low agglutinin, low gliandin, low reactive carbohydrates. There are some carbohydrates that would be fine, but there are some that would be more reactive. The gatherer is a kind of a thrifty genotype, so it's one that tends to have a lot of problems with what's called glycation. Tissue glycation is how you make, you know, if you ever watch a cooking show and they say we're going to caramelize the onions,
right.
Well, these people are caramelizing themselves. And essentially what they're doing is they're over time, they're generating lots of these burnt sugar proteins on their cells, and they can't get rid of it because they weren't made normally, so they can't be removed normally.
Right.
So these people go on to get diabetes, obesity, heart disease, hypertension, things like that. And they tend to be people who are programmed. They're part of that scarcity model that I told you about. Mm-hmm. They're programmed for scarcity, and then they come out and eat a normal diet and wonder why they're fat and everyone else is thin. Mm-hmm. The teacher, generally receptor type, you want to basically minimize cancer risk. You want to decrease the potential for overgrowth in the digestive tract. You talked about P53 at the very beginning, and that's a component of this. You're trying to basically cause a lot of tumor suppressor activity. You want to have your genes being always on the alert to, if they see cancer cells, they want to suppress them. The explorer is a weird hyperreactive genotype that tends to have a lot of environmental sensitivities. It tends to be the negative state of all the blood types. So it's the Rh negative, it's the type O. These are people with a lot of the cytochrome issues that give them a lot of the environmental sensitivities. They don't have good detoxification pathways. I mean, if you look at the polymorphisms associated with detoxification, the people that are like the canary in the mine kind of thing, they're hypersensitive. It's the only genotype you can get to by not having a specific blood type. It's one of the ones you can, it's the only one you can get no matter what your blood type is.
But I think one step back just to finish up. If you have six kids in the family,
but
you could have one of each of these.
Yeah, so sure. How do you make dinner?
Because the epigenetics drive it more than the genetics do.
Bingo.
Bingo. Peter D'Adamo, thank you again for making another great contribution. I enjoyed talking with you. You know, encyclopedic knowledge of this topic. It's controversial. You're going to be hearing a lot about this book. Certainly be a lot of media coverage. And I love the idea that we can actually start to study ourselves and use that information to guide us in our decision-making processes for what we put in our mouth, how we feed this machine.
Thank you very much.
Peter's book, The Genotype Diet, Change Your Genetic Destiny to Live the Longest, Fullest, and Healthiest Life Possible. It's a follow-up to Live Right for Your Type, which you wrote 10 years ago this year. And Dr. Oz, Open Friends. Be right back with the post-op.
Friends. Got a question for Dr. Oz? Leave a message at 1-866-OPRAH-XM or go to oprah.com. Now, back to Dr. Mehmet Oz on Oprah and Friends.
XM 156.
We're back at the post. I have Dr. Oz here, Oprah and Friends, Lisa and Mike at Jazz at Lincoln Center. So I think Peter D'Adamo was a pretty interesting guy, Lisa.
I was fascinated, riveted.
So as he was trying to get out of the room after the show, and Lisa caught him to corner him for a curbside consult, which followed up with a formal office visit arrangement now.
Well, I don't know about that, but I'm still curious how to put this into practice with a family of six different genotypes.
Well, the one issue, of course, is trying to feed your whole family this way.
You're going to have to open a fast food. six different, you know, it's like one of those things that the hospitals have where they have, you know, six different restaurants in one food court. You're going to need a food court at your home.
But I think one thing Peter does that I really want to applaud is he's taken it one level past where most of us stop. I must say, I thought the blood type diet is a very simplistic way of looking at it, although I can see why certain people move to certain parts of the world and they have a similar blood types and why that might be.
I think he's really developed it, hasn't he?
Beautifully. And I think it's really cool. We're not sure if it's true, and that's what the big issue that even Peter will admit. You know, it's hard to figure out if these six are the right ones for everybody. And in fact, if you change the foods that he argues are in your best interest to eat, if you're of these six types, it will make a huge difference. Those studies are challenging to do. that's stated, the reality that he wakes us up to the possibility that not just our genes, but the way they're expressed because of the environment around us, because of what we're putting in our mouths, can influence our health is something that all Americans have to wake up to. I must say, just the whole principle of looking at your finger swirls and the length of your upper versus lower legs, all these sort of self-examination.
You know,
points.
When my wife did this with kids, she looks at this finger. I always thought this was kind of voodoo.
No, but that's a good point, he says. You know, if
my wife never does anything that's voodoo, so I better be very careful.
Well, Dr. Oz, for Mike Royzen and Lisa Oz, thanks for joining us today. And Oprah and friends, our guest today, Peter Diadamo, The Genotype Diet. See you next time.
Live your best life.
Oprah and friends.
XM 156.